welcome to Clearer Thinking with Spencer Greenberg, the podcast about ideas that matter. I'm Josh Castle. I'm the producer of the podcast. Thanks so much for tuning in today. In this episode, Spencer speaks with Uri Bram. They talk about universities as cult institutions, global poverty interventions and outcome metrics, and more generally, the expected values of interventions and solutions proposed by organizations within the effective altruism movement. Now, before we dive into the conversation, I wanted to let you know that this episode includes a critique of GiveWell, a nonprofit dedicated to finding outstanding giving opportunities and publishing the full details of their analysis to help donors decide where to give. After recording this episode, we reached out to GiveWell to share this critique with them. They were very gracious. They listened and wrote a reply, and we've recorded their reply and placed it at the end of the episode. Thanks, and now we'll get on with the show.
Today, I wanted to welcome Uri Bram on the show. Uri, thanks for coming.
Thanks so much for having me, Spencer.
So the first thing I wanted to talk to you about is universities, which I think you have some pretty strong opinions about.
I've been known to have opinions about it. So essentially, my claim is if some aliens came down from space, I suppose, and saw that, you know, within some society, all of the elites, with a very broad definition of elites, all went away for 4 years to a weird institution where they got indoctrinated in, you know, like a particular culture, and very few of them ever used the esoteric knowledge that they gained in this place. The only ones who actually used it would be the priests who, you know, then leave this place in order to perpetuate it. They would basically just see this as a cult. And my claim is that we should basically see it as like a weird cult religious institution.
Okay, so let's unpack that. So if I understand correctly, what you're saying is that the knowledge taught in universities, generally speaking, is not used by most people when they leave the university. And furthermore, those that do use the knowledge are just the ones that end up going back into academia and perpetuating the same system. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
And so, I mean, I think that it seems pretty clear that when people defend universities, they often say things like, well, you're not really learning specific factual knowledge. You're more learning how to learn or learning how to be a thinker or something like that. So what do you think of those claims?
They just seem like very post hoc rationalizations. I had this argument once with a professor and I said, well, you know, like if our society taught everyone plumbing, bricklaying and, you know, I don't know, electricianing in their, you know, institutions of higher learning, then we'd have lots of, post hoc rationalizations about how those help you learn how to problem solve and how to think about problems and look at problems in new ways. And it, you know, would be also partly true. I mean, I'm sure there is a lot to learn from being an electrician in terms of learning how to solve interesting problems. But, you know, it's just like an arbitrary set of disciplines that we've ended up studying.
Do you think it's totally arbitrary? Or do you think that there's something about the disciplines that we choose that are kind of fundamental to the structure of knowledge? Like, for example, you might argue that, okay, you know, we've got English. Well, you know, that's because we have to use language, and we've got math because, you know, that's how we describe patterns, and we've got science. So, you know, it feels like it's not completely arbitrary to me.
How confident are you, I guess, in that feeling that it's non-arbitrary? Because yeah, it's sort of taking into account, like I said, whatever we grew up with and whatever we had in our society would come to seem natural and would have some arguments in favor of it.
Yeah, well, I guess I would say I think there's a lot of different ways of carving up knowledge. Like you could imagine an alien world where they just carve things up differently. Like rather than thinking of, you know, English versus math versus computer science, maybe they have, you know, one field which is just data, and it just like covers data across every, you know, whether it's data in chemistry or data in, you know, from mathematical perspective or physics perspective or whatever. Mm-hmm, and, you know, and maybe they have another, you know, set of courses that covers, you know, beauty or something like that. And it doesn't matter whether it's music or art or so. Yeah, I definitely think there's an arbitrariness there in like the ways that you cut it up. But it also does seem to me like, you know, mathematics, science, literature, there is something fundamental in the sense that these do seem like some of the greatest inventions of humans. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I am a knowledge worker, and I do use, you know, various kinds of maths and English and so on in my everyday life. But I still feel that the maths and English that I learned in university was almost completely useless.
What do you feel like the difference is, right? Because, you know, you're using math. You wrote a book, Thinking Statistically, that was very popular, right?
Did.
So you're using mathematics. You're writing, right? You took, you know, classes on English and writing and literature. So what's the difference between what you're doing in your job, where you're a professional writer, and what you were taught in university?
Yeah, I mean, so for the writing side of it, firstly, all my writing in university was judged almost entirely by one person, whereas everything I've done since then, and that person had, I mean, the professor had to read my essay, whether she liked it or not. And presumably most of the time she didn't, because she was facing a pile of 20 essays by 20-year-olds who knew very little about the world, at least relative to the professor. So yeah, one of the big differences is that since university, a lot more of my writing has been about, you know, kind of mass audiences and trying to make something interesting to someone who doesn't have to read it. Another part of it, I suppose, would be the fact that since university, I have to decide what to write. Like, a lot of my problems with writing are more about figuring out, you know, how to craft something or what to craft, you know, these kind of like meta level decisions that didn't come up as much in university. Like in university, I mainly got either assigned a topic or very early in the semester or what have you, I would choose a topic, which I then had to write about whether or not I started to hate it.
This reminds me of, so when I did my math PhD, it struck me how you take so many classes where you learn different mathematical theorems and mathematical approaches, but you don't have a single class on like creating new math. Mm-hmm, but creating new math is exactly what you're expected to do in your PhD. And so you're supposed to somehow assimilate it from your thesis advisor or through the ether or something like this. But there seems to be no attempt to formally teach it. And it reminds me of what you're saying, where you know, you have all these classes on English, but there's no class on how do you come up with what to write about, or you know, how do you write stuff that people actually want to read?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, in some sense, this was the genesis of my first book. Was I had a conversation with my thesis advisor, who was a really lovely guy. I still, you know, think very highly of him. But he was an econometrician, and
was this your undergraduate thesis?
Yes, this is my undergraduate thesis. I only have one degree. My hatred for universities has, you know, I've at least partly acted on it by not going back and getting more degrees.
At least you're consistent.
Yeah. I mean, you know, at the time I was too young to know any better, but since experiencing the place, I have stepped away. Though you could argue that it would be correct to argue at least at some point that was because I, you know, didn't get good enough grades in undergrad and therefore didn't think I would get into a good enough grad school for my own self.
Are you saying your entire hatred of universities might just be post hoc rationalization about your own bad grades?
Seems perfectly plausible, sure. Though, yeah, I often think back and I'm like, oh, that's the luckiest thing that ever happened to me was that I didn't get good enough grades to get into grad school, or else I might have been miserable for the last 10 years instead of, you know, only the first four of those. So, well done me, I think. What was I talking about? So I was talking to my undergraduate thesis advisor and just casually one day I said, oh, like Bayes' theorem, how many of the undergrads here do you think know about Bayes' theorem? And he said, oh, everyone knows Bayes' theorem, like 100%. Then he paused for a second and sort of reflected on it more. And then he said, actually, maybe 99%. I guess like the music and the art majors, maybe they don't know. So only 99. And I thought about that and I thought, well, just like based on my experience, I think maybe 10% of the undergrads know what Bayes' theorem is. Like it's not a commonly known thing. And then it struck me that, yeah, like the entire teaching apparatus had been geared around facts and not concepts so much. So like nobody taught these elementary concepts, these like kind of building block concepts. They just assumed that you knew the concepts. So if you took an intro stats class, it was just, you know, very, very slowly walking you through how to do a t-test rather than...
So you're saying they assume that you already knew the basic theoretical concepts like Bayes' theorem, even though actually nobody had bothered to teach them.
That is my opinion. It's very easy to, you know, sit here in my chair. It's not an armchair, but it is a chair. It's very easy to sit in my non-armed chair and complain about what other people do. And, you know, presumably teaching is very hard and there's lots of...
Well, you do teach though. I mean, you teach through popular books. So it feels like you're taking that head on.
That's true.
Which you probably write them from your armchair too.
Sure, that is true. Yeah. So maybe I am.
Well, you know, I think this raises an interesting question about what is worth remembering, right? Mm-hmm. And I actually think that facts are often maligned, where people say, well, why would you need to remember a fact if you can just go look it up in a book, right? Mm-hmm. But I think what that kind of misses is that you have to know at least about the existence of the fact in order to know that you even needed the fact. So an example would be, let's say for some reason you have to work with triangles, like maybe you're doing measurements of things, right? Mm-hmm. If you didn't know about the existence of the Pythagorean theorem, then you would have trouble calculating the lengths of sides of triangles. You don't have to memorize the formula. You can always look that up on Wikipedia, but you have to at least, when you're working with a triangle, notice, oh, hey, I need to calculate the size of the side. There's this thing called the Pythagorean theorem, and you have to know to look it up, right? So I think that a lot of times it's not the actual formula or something like that that we have to remember. It's that we have to kind of have a hook in our mind that there is something mm-hmm, to know about mm-hmm. on a topic, and then it has to be recalled at the right moment so we can go then, you know, get the knowledge that we need. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that sounds right. I struggle to figure out which things I actually know and which things I just derive. So for instance, I think I don't actually know any multiplication. I think all I actually do is addition. And when I'm, you know, when I think I'm doing mental multiplication, what I'm actually doing is adding a bunch of things together. And I just memorized, I mean, I literally memorized the multiplication table as most 6-year-olds or whatever do, and then use that as building blocks.
Well, but if you do 3 times 3, don't you just get the answer 9 pop into your head? Or?
Yes. Yes, I do. But if I do 3 times 27, I actually don't conceptually do the multiplication. I just add up. Oh, I'm going to embarrass myself here. 3 times 7, and then I add that to 3 times 20, which I've also memorized or effectively memorized.
But that seems like a pretty good method. You're just decomposing into component pieces that you have memorized. But I think that
I'm glad math PhD approves my multiplication technique.
I certainly
approve. That's very validating. Yeah.
I certainly approve. But I think that your example is a really good one about like what knowledge is, because essentially what you're doing is you're taking these little chunks of knowledge, like 3 times 3, that are just pure memorization. And you're combining them with more flexible rules, like the way you can distribute a multiplication across an addition, right? Mm-hmm, and it's actually to answer that more complicated question, you don't memorize every single combination of 22 times 7, 22 times 4, 22, right? Like that's not an efficient way to learn, but you do need those little building blocks memorized that then you can like combine flexibly to solve the problem you have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I don't know whether I'm derailing a new thread or re-railing a previous thread, but my critique of universities is actually a lot more cultural than it is about the specific things they teach. So I could imagine universities that taught the same subjects they teach now, but which I would find more valid.
So what would that look like, your valid university? Yeah.
I don't know, but the current ones I just see as mainly institutions of acculturation. Like there are people who go to college and there's people who don't go to college. And this is like a massive social and cultural divide. I often ask people like, do you know anyone? It's probably obvious at this point. I went to college and hang out with other people who went to college. I ask people, do you know anyone dating anyone who didn't go to college? And the answer is almost overwhelmingly no. You know, in my friend circles, everyone, you know, has friends who are dating, you know, same-sex partners or interracial partners. You know, like there'll be at least one person in your life who is doing all kinds of, you know, dating things. But most people I know zero people who are dating someone who didn't go to college. And that is like an insane social schism that I think people aren't even aware of, because college is the great cultural divide.
So what percentage of Americans went to college? I think it's what, 34%? Does that sound right?
Mm-hmm. It's slightly more for women than for men, but I think it's around there.
Right. So, I mean, so that is actually really related to this idea of these kind of cultural bubbles that we can live in. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember Slate Star Codex, the blog, talking about how many trans people the author knows, which is, given that, you know, very small percentage of people are trans, you'd expect just a priori, you know, to know maybe one, maybe two, but not 10, right? That would be really surprising a priori. Yet somehow people knowing each other gets entangled with all these other variables. So we tend to meet people that are much more similar to each other than you would naively think. And, you know, so I think your point about college is kind of a similar idea, where sort of these cultural webs and webs of social connection get so entangled that you can end up meeting far more people that are much more rare, but you're not meeting people who don't have a college degree. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it was David Runciman in the LRB who wrote about this with relation to Brexit, basically saying that most politicians don't know anyone who didn't go to college. And the Brexit vote was at least partially predicted by whether you went to college or not. And that both was a problem in terms of not knowing what their electorate actually wanted, but also a problem that after the Brexit vote went through, you know, since most of the politicians didn't know anyone who didn't go to college, they, you know, might be leading the country in a direction that people who didn't go to college don't actually want anymore. Like it's possible that those people have changed their minds. Like if you can't even be an effective populist demagogue if you don't really know the populace, was his point.
Oh, so they might think they know what the general population wants, but they don't really understand.
Trying to pander to something that they don't want, but they're not even pandering correctly potentially.
So do you think that going to college changes people's culture, or do you think that it's just selecting mainly for a certain culture?
Yeah. I think it certainly changed my culture, mainly in the sense that I went to college with people who were 3 or 4 social classes above me on the whole. And I think it was largely an acculturation into the upper class.
Interesting. So what kind of culture were you immersed in that was different than what you were used to?
I mean, like the comical but simple example is, like, I grew up, you didn't go to restaurants more than like 3 or 4 times a year, maybe. Mm-hmm. And then I went to college with people who find it normal to go to a restaurant every night of the week. Mm-hmm. It's that kind of thing where, like, at first I also grew up hanging my washing on washing lines. And literally my first day of college, I asked an American upperclassman where I could hang my washing, and she just laughed in my face.
Oh, man.
Which was, I thought, very cute, but funny. Anyway, things like this, like, you know, I think there was a lot of things that I at first really hated and then just internalized. And I think that's what college was really about. Did you feel, did you feel that your college experience changed you culturally or selected for you?
Well, I feel like my parents would always tell me I was going to college when I was young and set really high expectations for me. So it was sort of like, you know, I never even felt like I had any kind of choice on the matter. There's some part of me that wonders whether, you know, if I just gone and learned on my own, would I have learned a lot more during those 4 years? I think it's an interesting question. But as someone who studied applied math and computer science, I also felt like that was one of the most, it was a very like rigorous area to go study in college, in the sense that I really felt like I genuinely learned a huge amount.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously many people feel that in college, but I think some people feel like their field of study, they don't learn that much.
Yeah, I always wish that I had studied applied stats or computer science. I feel, looking back, I feel like those are the two really useful degrees I could have done.
But, you know, even that being said, even though I do feel like I learned a ton and that it was rigorous in a lot of ways, I still didn't use most of what I learned, right? Uh-huh. So, like, if you, you know, still, you know, well over 80%, maybe 95% of what I learned, I probably forgot and never used again. And then, you know, there's a question, did it somehow create a better, you know, version of myself as a future mathematician that, you know, so that, you know, imbued me with some thinking skills that I'm not aware of. I mean, I think for mathematics, I do see that as somewhat plausible. Like, there's certain ways of thinking mathematically that I feel like I do use in everyday life. For example, just thinking with an optimization mindset, what are the different algorithms that you can use to find the maximum of a function? And you can visualize this, you know, metaphorically as you can visualize the function as a mountain or a series of mountain ranges where the height of the mountain is like high up you are on the function. And so basically your position is the current input to the function. That's where you're standing on the mountain. And the question is, how do you go from where you're standing right now to the top of the highest peak, right? Mm-hmm. What's the algorithm you use? And so, you know, you've got simple algorithms like, okay, well, look at the ground where you're standing and look at where it's the current place you're standing is going up the steepest and take one step in that direction and then look around again and do the same thing. So you just keep taking whatever step gets you up, you know, the fastest on the next step. Mm-hmm. And that's the gradient ascent algorithm. Mm-hmm. And so that's just like one way of thinking about how to get up the mountain. And then there's all lots of more sophisticated ways to do that. But anyway, that's just one example of kind of like an idea in math that even if I don't necessarily use the mathematics of it daily, I feel like that way of thinking really affected me.
I guess my question is all about opportunity costs. So you spend 4 years in college, and if you expect people have roughly a 40-year career, that's 10% of their working life that they just spent on this thing. And so the question is not just like, do you learn anything, but do you learn commensurate with that time? And then I want to add on top of that I feel like I had more energy in university than I've ever had since. And so I feel like those were the four probably most energetic years of my life.
And you don't think that was caused by being in the university, maybe?
I don't think so, but I might be wrong. I mean, it has partly caused just by insecurity and, you know, lack of money. I think those are very motivating things. So in a sense, if I had started working sooner, perhaps I would have overcome some of those things sooner and lost some of the energy. It's true. I don't know that.
You could always put your money into a trust that you can't access for 5 years and then, you know, yourself up into new energy.
It's hilariously hard to reproduce the things that truly motivate you. I mean, so I think, you know, not quite fear of death, but like awareness of one's own mortality is like the other great motivator in my life. And in theory, I could recreate that motivation for myself, but it's been impossible to do it. Like it seems impossible to force myself into it.
Yeah, well, just don't take up free solo climbing, you know? I don't think that's a good route.
even if it lets me ascend the gradient. I've never been able to throw a, you know, like stochastic gradient ascent joke into any conversation in my life till now. So thank you for making that possible.
I'm not sure that counts as a joke, but
No, in a week. Reference.
There you go.
Go with that.
If you're looking to test or improve your critical thinking, there's an engaging way to do so with clearerthinking.org. by integrating useful insights from psychology and economics into fun, interactive programs, clearerthinking.org helps you to make better decisions, create new habits, and achieve your goals. Whether you have just 5 minutes or an hour, you can use more than 30 interactive tools for free on their website. Try the rationality test, which tells you which of 16 reasoning styles best matches your thinking. Or the common misconceptions game to see if you are over or underconfident when you bet on what's fact or fiction. Clearer Thinking's work is based on scientific research about how to shift behavior in the real world. So check out their free tools and tests at clearerthinking.org.
So let's talk about global poverty now. I know you have some opinions around specifically global poverty interventions related to deworming. Do you want to just talk for a moment about what deworming is and then we can get into some of the evidence?
Yeah, so the well-known and well-loved charity recommendation service, GiveWell, has a few top interventions that they think consistently, effectively tackle global poverty. And one of them is deworming. There's this particular kind of worms that are very common in many parts of sub-Saharan Africa, and it's very, very cheap to treat them.
These are parasitic worms, so they affect your body, right?
In quite horrible ways, yes. And many, many children get infected, and there's this proven medicine that is relatively cheap and plentiful. But yeah, for a long time, you know, many children weren't getting treated anyway. And so GiveWell's recommendation was that treating these worms is a very, very impactful way to reduce global poverty. Their finding was that treating these worms in children 20 or 30 years later led to adults with much higher incomes.
And my understanding is that they don't even bother testing for the worms, right? They just go and give them to a whole school because the pills are so cheap that basically the idea is that you might as well give it to everyone. And I guess that assumes that there are not bad side effects for these.
Yes, that is my understanding also.
Great. And so, you know, just to give a little more background, this is not the only thing GiveWell recommends. They also recommend the Against Malaria Foundation that works on insecticide-treated bed nets for preventing malaria. And I think they recommend Give Directly, which is a charity that tries to give money to some of the poorest people in the world really, at a really efficiently. But this is one of the recommended charities is these deworming charities. So when you investigated this, what was your interpretation of the evidence?
So I was skeptical of the argument proposed in the GiveWell paper. I want to say something that I really appreciate about GiveWell is that I think if you read through the GiveWell paper where they, you know, were about to recommend it, they say so many times, they mention so many possible flaws with this, and they have so many caveats and so many, you know, maybe this is going on and maybe this evidence is not that strong. But I think any normal person reading it would come to the end and think, oh, this organization is about to anti-recommend this charity. And I really do, like, in terms of epistemic humility, I really appreciate that they, you know, like, did all that work for us in a sense of saying, like, oh, these are possible flaws with our analysis. But
when I've read their blog post, I feel like they're incredibly good about kind of trying to admit what they don't know and the limitations of their work and caveating things. It's really hard to fault them for that. And, you know, it's hard to think of anyone who's better at that than GiveWell is.
Well done, GiveWell. And, much appreciation your way. However, nonetheless, I still got to the end of it and thought they should not have recommended deworming charities, at least based on the evidence that I read on their website.
And to be fair, this was a few years ago. So it's possible there's new evidence.
That is also true. I have not read it today. So it is possible that it's been updated. But I'd still say, like, you know, I think I have a critique here. You know, that recommendation was up for a long time based on the evidence that was there, you know, 2 years ago. And so I think GiveWell, you know, like, if I think GiveWell thinks along similar lines in terms of, like, what is good and bad evidence. And so I think if I could convince them on this point, they would agree that, it was unfortunate that they did recommend it 2 years ago, even if by luck it turns out that now that recommendation is more sound.
So what is the kind of nature of your critique?
So there's three parts to my critique. One part is just that it was based on very few studies, and the studies really overlapped each other. So, you know, they were in one very small part of the world, like Kenya and Uganda, to the point where there were three separate studies, but, you know, two of them actually had the same catchment area along the Kenya-Uganda border. And as far as I could tell, it was just luck that, so because GiveWell only accepts a couple of outcome variables, and one of them is income. And obviously, if you treat children, the income doesn't come through for another 15, 20 years. These are kind of like the only end goods that GiveWell accepts in its
That must be so hard to study though, right? Because you kind of give people these deworming pills and then wait around for 15 to 20 years to see if there's an impact.
I think one of many reasons that there's a lot of uncertainty there, but also as a result, you know, like it so happened that one of the first academics to do like a rigorous RCT did it on these deworming pills.
So just step back. So RCT stands for randomized controlled trial. And that's basically where you're going to be giving some people these pills and other children are not going to get the pills. And it's going to be random.
Yes.
Who gets the pills? I assume it's randomized by school probably or something like that.
Yeah. So there was, it was, and there was, I think, some issues around that as well in terms of, again, issues raised by GiveWell in terms of the school randomization. Because obviously the schools have slightly different catchment areas. There was some flooding in some places and not others. So there was like extreme viral loads, not viral loads, parasitic loads in some places and not others. But yeah, so my critique is firstly was that it felt a little arbitrary that this thing just happened to have been studied 20 years earlier and now we're getting the results from it. But also again, like GiveWell says in its argument that there's so many uncertainties with this, that they themselves claim that there's a 2% probability that this actually has the effect that they think it does. And their argument is that it's so effective and so cheap, the pills are so cheap and the income outcomes are so high that even when you use that figure of, 2% probability that this actually works, it's still worth doing and still makes it the most effective intervention in the world.
So just to clarify, does that imply a 98% chance that does nothing according to their own model?
That is my understanding, yes.
And then, so it's like there's a 2% chance that it helps at all. And that sounds terrible, but in fact, the pills are so cheap. and if it does work, that 2% chance is so effective. It's such a large increase that even multiplying by 0.02, it still becomes incredibly cost effective, right? Right.
And there's a lot of reasons. Firstly, as I mentioned, there was flooding in this area at the time, and there was potentially a particularly high parasitic, load at the time. And therefore, it's possible that this intervention is super effective when a lot of kids have worms, but is not as effective when kids have fewer worms or they don't have worms at all. They were extrapolating from, this one part of the world to other parts of the world. So, they themselves say, just because it works in Kenya and Uganda, the Horn of Africa, what have you, that doesn't mean that it works in Southern Africa. It doesn't necessarily mean that it works in Western Africa, India. So they were taking these findings and applying them in other contexts. And they themselves said, there's a risk that, even if it did work the first time, it won't necessarily work in other places.
But surely it must make a massive difference whether, 50% of students are infected or 1%, right? That's going to completely destroy the effect size if only 1%.
Absolutely. So again, this is, again, hats off to GiveWell. They list every single one of these things. And at the end of it, and here is where I want to push back on them, is they say, if you add this all together, it's like taking a card from a deck. So taking one card at random from a deck is about 2% probability that you'll get, say, the Ace of Spades. And they say, yeah, if someone offered you $1 million if you pull the Ace of Spades and it only costs you $1, then of course you should do it, even though, most likely you're not going to win the million. Now, my critique is that this isn't actually valid when you're multiplying together a bunch of different possible problems. So as they said, there was many, many reasons why this result might not hold up.
So that 2% comes from saying, well, we have some uncertainty in this and some uncertainty in this and some uncertainty in this, and they kind of all get combined. And that's where you get down to the 2%. Is that the idea?
Right. Absolutely. And then, yeah, I'd love to get your take on this. But my impression is that this is not a valid way to combine uncertainties.
Well, it's a really interesting question. From a mathematical perspective, what you're really trying to model is kind of the joint distribution. What's the conditional distribution. What's the probability that this has different effect sizes on income? It raises income by 5%, that it raises by 10%, it raises by 20%. So what's the probability of those different amounts of income effects conditioned on all the information we know, which is, every single variable, of data that's been collected. And that probability model, ideally in a perfect world, we would just be able to crank that through some kind of machine and it would give us that probability distribution, right? Given all the evidence. But in reality, we have no thing that does that, right? So basically what we end up doing is we end up kind of simplifying every little piece of evidence, saying, well, this one, we don't really know how to interpret it, but maybe it cuts the probability of it working in half. And this other one, well, we're not really sure the distribution of this thing. So maybe, maybe we divide it by three, And so it's like, it ends up being, in practice, a lot of times you just have to end up kind of making guesses about each of these inputs, right?
Right. And I think when you add the uncertainties around the uncertainties, effectively, I think this thing most likely doesn't work. At least doesn't work in the sense of, you know, raising people's incomes. At least I would say we don't have evidence that it raises people's incomes.
Well, but they would also say it most likely doesn't work, right? So what's the difference between your most likely it doesn't work and there? I think you're, at the end of the day, you're disputing that you can take the expected value. You're disputing that you can just say, well, take your kind of point estimate for the probability that it works times the effect divided by the cost. And, you know, so where do you see the logic break down? Is it because the error, somehow the error bars on that 2% are so big that you feel like it's not justified to just multiply through?
Basically, if any one of these things is broken, there's basically only one direction in which the error goes, I think. As in, any one of these factors that means the result doesn't replicate, holds up in any given case, then the outcome is zero, right?
So you don't view it as symmetrical, whereas like each variable, it could like, you know, they let's say they guess that this one thing reduces the chance by 50%, but it could be 70% or it could be 30%. So they could be over or underestimating, but you don't see it that way. You're saying more like if you make a logical deductive argument, right? If I say A implies B and B implies C and C implies D, if any of those are wrong, the entire chain falls apart, right?
That is my take, yes. And again, like, I'm not saying that this thing doesn't work. I'm just saying that we don't have evidence that it does work, which again, if you're GiveWell and if what you're doing is recommending the charities that we have the best evidence for, I'm not saying that deworming is a bad idea. I'm just saying that as far as I can tell, we have no more evidence for deworming than we have for any other intervention. And GiveWell, you know, is directing a lot of money at a very small number of causes. And that doesn't hold up for me.
One thing I find really interesting about that is that, like, I think a lot of people think about GiveWell as trying to recommend the stuff that has the most evidence behind it. Mm-hmm. But what I think you're suggesting here is that it's not that they have tons of evidence that this thing works. It's that they think the expected value is high when they multiply their uncertainty by the effect, which is there's something a little bit ironic about that, because I think a lot of people, they like to give the things like GiveWell recommended charities because they think, well, this may not be the best thing in the whole world, but it's the best thing in the world we can be confident about, or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. It's like we like it because we think almost surely it's doing a lot of good. Whereas like maybe it's actually somewhat more in the class of things that like could do tons of good, might be well worth it, but are actually highly speculative. And then if you put it in that class, it starts to look a lot more like many other things, right? There's all kinds of things that like look like they might be high expected value, but are highly speculative and maybe do no good at all, right?
Right. And I think this is an interesting question in terms of kind of what should GiveWell do about it? Because I actually looked at their website. I think I looked at their website in the Wayback Machine or archive.org or whatever. And, you know, over the years, they had actually changed how they presented it. And they, you know, continuously kept presenting it more and more in kind of the terms that you said. And I think they're somewhat aware that this is what they're doing. But I agree that I suspect many of their donors don't. And then you have a question of like, how much responsibility do they have to really scream, no, we're not doing what you think we're doing, even though they have said explicitly that they're doing this thing.
Right. If you read their blog post, it's not like hidden.
It's not hidden.
But most people are not going to dig into, you know, the entire blog post. That's probably thousands of words, if not tens of thousands.
Yeah. I think there is a problem of, you know, like sort of a broader social problem, I guess, of a lot of people who I've met who donate to GiveWell or GiveWell recommended charities because they think other people have read the blog posts and their sense is, oh, like this has been checked. My sense is that very few people have actually read the blog post and that, you know, everyone is thinking, oh, someone else has read this, therefore like it's been okayed. Mm-hmm. But when I sort of discovered this issue or what I think is an issue, unless I'm, you know, it's shown otherwise, very few of the people who I wanted to talk to about it had actually read the blog post to be able to, you know, sort of argue about it or, you know, debate the point.
Here's something that I find so confusing about this. You know, we're talking about these parasitic worm infections. You'd think it would just be obvious if people felt better, right? Like you could, you know, give the students a survey, you know, right before they get treated and give them another one right after and say like, how do you feel? You know, and ask a bunch of questions and like, if you're seeing them, like they're like, oh, I have so much more energy, I can concentrate better in school, all these things, you'd be like, oh, okay, well, that doesn't prove definitively, but like, okay, it, you know, it's suggestive that this is doing something. Whereas if you found the reverse, you'd be like, well, maybe this does nothing. And so I'm confused about why we don't have that much shorter term, faster evidence, even, you know, that kind of can bolster the longer term evidence. Not that it by itself is enough, but you want it in addition to the other evidence.
So this is my last critique, and it's actually, I think, worse than it seems, which is that, according to GiveWell, and I'm not an expert on deworming, so I'm taking GiveWell's information here. That's my basis. But they said that none of the mechanistic paths that they expected actually were affected by the deworming. So, you know, they were expecting deworming to, you know, increase children's weights and, you know, get children better grades in school, like all these things. And it had one physical consequence, but in general, for instance, it didn't increase the kids' grades in schools, but somehow it did increase their income 15 years later.
Right. So that raises this kind of mechanistic question of like, how does it raise their income? Right. If it, you'd assume it somehow makes you feel better. Maybe it affects your, you know, fatigue or maybe even your cognition, but those things you'd expect would actually help you in the immediate term, right? With your grades.
Right. Right. And so it seems if you can't find any plausible mechanistic path for something like this, which seems relatively simple. I mean, again, it could be that, you know, it has some effect on people that we can't trace, and therefore it really does increase their incomes 20 years later. But for something that seems relatively straightforward, if you can't find a mechanistic path, you should increase your uncertainty that your result is actually wrong, and that actually this was, you know, something went wrong in the study. Actually, these pills don't increase kids' incomes 20 years later at all. And that it seems very strange to me from a causal perspective to say, oh, well, we couldn't find all of the obvious mechanisms that weren't affected, and yet we're confident that, or even 2% confident that, you know, this really did work.
Right. I mean, you could speculate about possible causal mechanisms that would have that kind of effect. We're like, okay, maybe it's not about the immediate effects of the worms. Maybe there's some kind of chronic condition that develops over a long period when you have the worms. But then now it's just pure speculation. Is like, is there any evidence that any of these other causal mechanisms could produce this kind of effect? And then I agree with you, without a mechanism, it does, you know, I think we should put greater uncertainty on it. But, you know, another charity they recommend is GiveDirectly. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've looked into that, but, you know, basically the idea, as I mentioned before, is just trying to give money to very, very poor people and to get it to them in a way where they can't game the system, they can't pretend to be poor, and also get to them efficiently, where, like, not a lot of money is wasted on the way. And, you know, I feel like that, my belief that that is probably a really good thing to do, actually has a lot more to do with just the general belief that if you give a really poor person who's not poor due to any fault of their own money, they're probably going to figure out some way to improve their life with it. Mm-hmm. But probably my belief depends less on the kind of randomized control trials than on that general, what it seems to be like a, you know, pretty common sense notion that that's a useful thing to do. What do you think about that?
Yeah, likewise. And sort of my feeling that it's a good thing is based on, you know, knowing many people who are extremely cash constrained and are living in, you know, like global poverty. And from experience, it seems to me that giving them money makes their lives better. And though I should point out that, again, as of 2 years ago, it's possible they've updated this, but the only two outcomes that GiveWell considers is income and, I think, child nutrition. So, like, they're not saying that it's not, you know, how happy people are, it's not their well-being. It's not even, if you pitch them a charity that's like a school and you say, oh, look, we've successfully, you know, increased kids, you know, maths and literacy scores, GiveWell isn't interested. Like, that is not an outcome that they accept as good. And at some point, you have to accept some outcomes as objective goods. And they've chosen, you know, income and child nutrition. But I don't know if their donors realize that necessarily. And in a sense, like, GiveDirectly, yes, if GiveDirectly gives people money and it turns out that that does consistently cause people to have more money, which sounds like I'm making fun of it, but it's not, you know, like, it could be that giving people money somehow, you know, doesn't actually increase people's incomes longer term. That's possible.
Right. I guess it could be just a short-term effect or something.
Yeah.
You want to show that, like, oh no, even, you know, a year later, 2 years later, they either have more money or they've spent that on things that, like, were genuinely useful to themselves, which I would certainly expect to be the case. But it feels to me there that the randomized control trials are sort of just like checking to make sure, rather than, like, you know, there's such a strong a priori argument that's going to be helpful.
I might be wrong, but I think GiveWell doesn't count. You know, if you took the money and spent it in a one-off way that didn't increase your long-term wealth or income, then GiveWell wouldn't count that either.
Isn't a lot of the money in GiveDirectly spent on, like, for example, fixing roofs?
That's their classic example, yeah.
Does that actually increase income, or does that just make people have better lives where their roof is not constantly leaking and they have to move their family out when it rains and stuff like that?
Yeah. So my understanding of it is that that's like a classic capital constraints thing where, you know, the metal roof is a better long-term investment and per year you spend less on the metal roof, but people are so cash constrained in the short term that they just can't buy the metal roof. So they end up buying the straw roof year after year after year, spending more money in the long run. So GiveDirectly enables them to buy the metal roof and therefore they're like, spendable income in future years is higher. We're not even considering, as far as I know, GiveWell isn't considering just the benefit of having a nicer roof. This is in a Terry Pratchett novel. I forget the name, but it's like the Sam Grimes theory of boots.
where one of the characters says the problem with being poor is that you can't afford like good boots, and therefore your boots keep wearing out, and therefore you end up spending way more money on boots than the rich guy who buys a nice pair of leather boots that last him the rest of his life.
So that's really interesting. And it also suggests that like GiveWell is being very conservative in a way, because they're saying, okay, we're just going to give credit to this intervention for like future income effects. And yeah, we know there must be all these other benefits, right? Like, you know, you're not getting wet when it rains,
right,
and
right.
Not having your stuff destroyed and all this kind of stuff.
So I spoke to them directly about the education example. And yeah, they said that in order to look at a school, you would either need evidence that the school children made more money 20 years later, which obviously you can't get for 20 years, or evidence that it improved child nutrition. And obviously, you know, so they did ask about this, like, can you show that a school is improving child nutrition through better lunches or whatever? And this is possibly true, but this is a very inefficient way to feed children. You know, running a whole school in order to feed kids is obviously not going to be a cost-efficient intervention. So yes, they are being very conservative in the sense that I think a lot of their donors and a lot of people in the world would say, oh yeah, you know, I accept maths and literacy are good things, and that if, you know, a kid gets better grades in school, that is just good on its own. But GiveWell doesn't accept this. And one of the reasons they say they don't accept this is that potentially if everyone in a town started getting better grades, it would just be an arms race. You know, like 20 years later, the kids would be in equally bad jobs because, you know, they're competing with each other. Again, this is not my claim. This is what, as I understand it, this was GiveWell's position. And unless they've changed it, it's still GiveWell's position.
Well, you know, I certainly can understand and sympathize with the idea that a lot of like these intermediate measures may not be that good. You know, an example in health would be like, okay, let's say you have a pill that reduces cholesterol, and we think cholesterol reduction is linked to better health, mm-hmm, but what mm-hmm. if it just reduces cholesterol? It doesn't actually lead to better health, and maybe it even makes you die more. You know, so you've got to be really careful about these intermediate variables. And I think that this is actually just such a major problem with charities in general, which mm-hmm, is mm-hmm. so much easier to collect the intermediate variables, like how many people came through our system? How many people did we give things to? How many people did we, you know, teach classes to? And it's so much harder to actually see, well, but what impact do they have on their lives? Are they happier? Are they better off? Mm-hmm. And so maybe it's a reaction to that, that there's so many of these like weak intermediate variables that you can't really prove if you've actually helped anyone.
I'm very sympathetic to this. And then I think about it in my own life. And then I think, well, ultimately, you know, sort of what, you know, do any of the intermediate variables matter? Maybe the only thing that matters is happiness. Maybe things that maybe we shouldn't take for granted that, you know, even extending life is a good thing. Maybe if you live for longer but you're unhappy, that's actually a net negative. It's quite a mind bender in the end. But I agree, I'm sympathetic. That's a really difficult problem.
Yeah, it's certainly a difficult problem. But you know, one more thing, just going back to GiveWell, is it's very hard for me to think of anyone that I trust to do this analysis more than them. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you think of a more trustworthy group that tries to answer these questions?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of my And you know, like, this is an organization where, like, I'm very happy to talk about my critique of them, you know, very publicly. And I don't fear, you know, I think they would take this very well and either agree with it or disagree with it. But, you know, if they agreed with it, I think they would be delighted that someone had like found some flaw in their reasoning that they hadn't spotted. Like, you know, they seem like great people. And
they're probably aware of this critique, is my guess.
Mm-hmm. Which therefore, should I update about the validity of the critique based on the fact that they're probably aware of the critique?
Well, it's getting pretty meta. I don't know.
But no, I don't know if there's anyone better. I guess, I mean, this is that part of the thing where you just say, well, I mean, here's some things that could happen that maybe would be better. Maybe it would be better if there were multiple GiveWells and those GiveWells could check each other's work more. And maybe it would be better if more people, you know, read the entirety of GiveWell's blog posts. I mean, maybe GiveWell could cause, you know, could pay some people or incentivize some people to read the whole blog posts. Maybe it'd be better if more people were aware that lots of other people hadn't read the blog posts, because the blog posts are very, very long. And it really is like a lot to get through.
But it seems like 95 organizations out of 100 are not even going to tell you all the assumptions they're making.
Oh, yeah, and, yeah.
And so that's the fascinating thing, is the only reason you're able to level this critique is because they basically laid it after you on a silver platter, right?
I think James Baldwin said like he loves America more than any other country in the world, and that's why, you know, he feels happy to critique it forever. You know, the only reason I think it's worth, you know, reading GiveWell's blog post at length and critiquing them is because, yeah, like I really, really respect them. And I agree that 99% of charities wouldn't be anywhere near this rigorous and serious. And that's exactly the reason why I think it's worth the time and the effort to both read their blog posts and, you know, describe critiques with it, because I think they're great. And I want them to be even greater. So yeah, thank you, GiveWell, for all the work that you do. I genuinely mean that. I think, you know, it must take a ridiculous amount of work to produce the kind of research and analysis that they do.
No, I totally agree. I'm very grateful for the work they do. And I think that for anyone who's tried to investigate these topics, you suddenly realize just the incredible complexity that sort of explodes in front of you. Any one of these questions, as you dig into it, you're like, okay, well, there's a randomized control trial, but how exactly did they randomize? What if there was a spillover effect? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, and then there's a replication crisis. Like, how do we factor that? And what about generalizability? Like, okay, it worked in this area, but does it apply to this area? You know, it's really kind of incredible, all the considerations you have to go through. I have this intuition, and I can't prove this rigorously, but I'm curious what you think about this. My intuition is that a lot of the best things to do in the world, in terms of doing good, are things where they maybe have something like a 90% chance of not doing anything, or like a 90% chance of failure. Sort of like you can see that there's a reasonable way they might work, and if they worked, they'd be a really big deal. But you also kind of know that there's a pretty good chance that they're going to fail. So it's not, they're not like a 1 in 1,000 shot, but they're also not like a 90% chance of success shot. It's more like more like a startup where it's like, oh yeah, this has a pretty high chance of failure, but if it worked, wow, this could be really great. What's your thought on that?
Yeah, so I at your level, it sounds about right. You know, if you're doing something with a 10% chance of succeeding, but most people I know who go down that line of thought end up saying like, oh, this thing has a 0.001% chance of happening, but if it did happen, it would be either incredibly good or incredibly bad, and therefore we must spend all our energy either promoting it or preventing it. And that seems really suspect to me, though it's hard to say exactly why and where that kind of difference kicks in.
Yeah, well, you know, part of the reason why I like the kind of like, it's probably going to fail, but if it succeeded, wow, wouldn't that be amazing? Wouldn't that produce so much value? But not the, oh, this is a 1 in 1,000,000 chance of working, is that I think at the 1 in 1,000,000 chance of working, where you're like, oh, it's 1 in 1,000,000 chance of working, but if it worked, it would be so good that it would overwhelm that 1 in 1,000,000 chance by so much that still the expected value is incredibly high. But I don't think the human brain is good enough generally to tell the difference between like a 1 in 1,000 chance, a 1 in 1,000,000 chance, or a 1 in 1,000,000,000,000 chance. So it feels to me like the fact that you think it's 1 in 1,000,000 and that multiplies to a good number, but not 1 in 1,000,000,000,000, which would make it look bad, is almost arbitrary. And it almost is just path dependence due to which thoughts happen to bump into your mind or something like that. Whereas like when you get to 10%, maybe you don't know it's actually 10%. Maybe it's 20%. Maybe it's 5%. But like, you know, it's not 1 in 10,000, right? And on the flip side, I guess my problem with things that like seem like they have a 90% chance of success is just that those seem really competitive. It's like, why would there be this opportunity, there's a 90% chance of success, to just do this massive amount of good that nobody's done yet, right? Like, why is it, that's sort of like finding, you know, occasionally you might find dollar bills, but it's hard to find $100 bills, right? And so this is kind of the equivalent. It's like, yeah, you can see a lot of reasons why people wouldn't take shots at things that have 90% chance of failure, right? Like, there aren't that many people willing to take those kinds of shots, relatively speaking. Right. But like, who's not willing to take a 90% chance of having a massive positive impact, right? Like, that seems like way, way more competitive space.
Right. And I think most people who think they've discovered one of those 90% chance of success things then discover that the thing is just like a lot more complicated than they realize. And there's a ton of moving parts. And yeah, exactly. Because if it really was that easy, someone probably would have done it already. And sometimes has. Like, there are some things that are super beneficial and not that hard. And yeah, I think they have generally already been done.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's probably right. I guess maybe there are some exceptions and things that are just like really hard to think of. You know, maybe they're, you know, maybe if an alien mind was like thinking about problems in the world, they would see solutions just sitting all over the place that we would just never consider because their minds work so differently or something like that. But I generally agree. And I think that you kind of want to be looking for these things where you have good understanding of like why they haven't been solved yet. Well, one thing that's related to what we're talking about is this idea that a lot of times if there's a problem in the world that you want to help solve, you really have to understand the causal structure of what's going on. Because almost any big problem, there's probably hundreds, if not thousands or even tens of thousands of people have tried to solve it before. And so the fact that that problem is still very substantially exists suggests that something about the structure of the problem is causing everyone who tries to fail. And sort of like, so if the problem seems easy, it probably means there's hidden details you don't understand yet. It doesn't mean it's not solvable, but it probably means you have to investigate it very carefully, try to understand the structure of the problem, try to understand why others have failed, and then try to develop a strategy that at least won't fail for the same reasons others have failed, right?
Right. A friend of mine in Kenya, his brother went to agriculture school. So he studied for 4 or 5 years. And one of the things he learned was a better way of planting banana trees that would let you plant 5 times as many banana trees on a given amount of space. Yes, but here's the thing. His parents are banana farmers And he went home after agricultural school and was like, look, I've got this new technique. You plant them, I think it's kind of like in a hand shape for what it's worth, but you know, don't quote me on that. And his parents said, absolutely not. Like, we've always planted them this way. Whatever nonsense they put in your head in agricultural school, we're not interested, blah, blah, blah. And so this is like an example where, like, you could, if you were sitting in America studying in a university and you discovered this new technique, you could say, ah, oh, we could, you know, make people who are not, you know, earning subsistence money doing subsistence farming, we can improve their lives by teaching them this technique. But it turns out people won't even listen to their own kids when it comes to how you should plant bananas. And I think things like that come up just absolutely constantly, like all kinds of things that, you know, you might take for granted, people will not do them. And therefore, like, your theoretically useful innovation actually, yeah, just won't work in practice.
That's so interesting. It reminds me of this charity that was trying to get people to use chlorine in their drinking water in areas where there's, you know, oftentimes, you know, parasites, other bad stuff in the drinking water. And so the first thing they did is they took chlorine dispensers and they did something really brilliant, which is they put them at the water wells, right? Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. You're walking to the well and you see the chlorine dispenser, it's right there, it's convenient, you don't have to do anything. And people weren't using them very much. And so then they paired them with educational campaigns, trying to explain to people, like, here's why you should use them. You know, here's the benefits, and people still weren't using them very much. And what they ended up doing is, A, they realized that if the chlorine dispenser ever went empty, people would kind of just stop using it, even if they refilled it. So they had to spend all this time working on the supply chain to try to make sure these things would never go empty. I'm not quite sure why, whether people, maybe they just lose the habit if the things were sometimes empty, or maybe they, you know, would lose faith in the company or the organization. Mm-hmm. They also did this other thing where they actually would hire young people and they would give them t-shirts promoting using chlorine in your water, and they'd have them drive around on motorcycles trying to convince people to use the chlorine. But you read about this and you're like, oh my gosh, the level of difficulty of getting people to use this chlorine that was already right there on the well. You know, basically you have to deeply understand people's behaviors. What do they think about this? You know, it's just not enough to have the chlorine there. They have to understand why they're using it, what the benefits are, and, you know, maybe it tastes weird, you know? So it's like, there's so many different things to overcome there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, Uri. This was a delight, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Always a delight. Thank you, Spencer.
As we mentioned at the beginning, here's GiveWell's response to Uri's critique. They said, "We're excited to see this level of detailed engagement with our research. As Uri and Spencer note, one of the key reasons we share the full analysis behind our recommendations is precisely this, inviting fresh perspectives and debate on the conclusions we reach. We operate in an expected value framework when recommending top charities. We recommend deworming programs because of the possibility that deworming may have a large impact on long-term economic well-being. At less than $1 per treatment, we think it's a pretty good bet. We've discussed our views publicly over the years, such as in our blog post titled, Deworming Might Have Huge Impact, But It Might Have Close to Zero Impact. The case for deworming's long-term benefits does rely on a relatively small number of studies, and the mechanisms by which it has long-term impact are unclear. But when we account for these uncertainties in our impact estimates, it still remains promising. We've also supported research to better understand the impacts of deworming. We funded part of a study that measured the economic welfare of children who received deworming treatments 20 years later. This work was recently published, and at a high level, seems to support the story of deworming's long-term effects. Thanks again for discussing this topic. It's an important and thorny one." We just want to say thanks again to GiveWell for listening to our episode and sending us this reply. So thank you, GiveWell. And we've included in the show notes the transcript of this reply, as well as a few other corrections that GiveWell pointed out to us. Thanks again for listening. If you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email at clearerthinkingpodcast@gmail.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail at 321-341-4669. And if you do leave us a voicemail, we might even use the audio on an upcoming episode. To learn more about Spencer, visit spencergreenberg.com. To learn more about Uri, check out his bio in the show notes. And to learn more about our show, visit clearerthinkingpodcast.com. If you enjoyed the show, we hope you'll rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts and share us with your friends on social media. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.